I just read a new book called The Coffins of Little Hope, the fourth novel by Timothy Shaffer. Shaffer is now the master of a kind of Great Plains Gothic, by turns funny and moving, charming and odd, all with a dead-on sense of the American Midlands. I grew up in Nebraska, and the story is set in Nebraska. My first job at age 17 was writing obituaries for my hometown newspaper, and the novel's narrator is the obituary writer for her local paper. She's Essie Miles, 83 years old.
I still use a manual typewriter, a 1953 Underwood portable in a robin's egg blue, because the soft pip, pip, pip of the typing of the keys on a computer keyboard doesn't quite fit with my sense of what writing sounds like. I need the hard metal clack. And I need those keys to sometimes catch so I can reach in and untangle them, turning my fingertips inky. Without slapping the return or turning the cylinder to release the paper with a sharp whip, without all that minor havoc, I feel I've paid no respect to the dead. What good is an obituary if it can be written so peaceably, so undisturbingly, in the dark of night? Though my name does not begin with an S, my byline has always been S. Miles, because I'm Esther, but more often Essie or S, and thus capital S, just S, no period, on the page.
That's Lois Smith reading from The Coffins of Little Hope. One of the novel's main plots concerns a little girl, a missing girl named Lenore. Her mother says she was abducted, but some people in the town think she never existed at all. It's a mystery that the author Timothy Shaffer never entirely resolves.
And I knew early on that I didn't want to write a missing child comedy or even, you know, a satire.
Although there haven't been many of those missing child comedies.
Right. They're kind of hard to market, I'm sure. But I did want to kind of sort of examine how we as a culture will build pilgrimage, essentially, and shrines to things that have roots in turmoil and crisis. And so, and I guess it's not the most original plot. I mean, I think I was thinking about it after that Jodie Foster movie where she gets on a plane with her daughter and then the daughter disappears. But I wanted to play with that a little bit in the book and to have those questions arise, not just for the characters in the book, but possibly for the reader as well.
On this girl, we pinned all hopes of our dying town's salvation. The longer we went without seeing her even once, the more and more dependent upon her we grew. She became our leading industry, her sudden nothingness a valuable export, and we considered changing the name of our town to hers. We would live in the town of Lenore. Is it any wonder that we refused to give up hope despite all the signs that she'd never existed, that she'd never been anybody? Never, not even before she supposedly vanished?
When I started this story, I actually didn't even really know who the narrator was. I mean, I knew, I was thinking I wanted a kind of collective first person, like one of my favorite stories, A Rose for Emily by William Faulkner, in which you had a character who wasn't necessarily speaking for herself, but speaking on behalf of the community. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get too far into it before the narrator actually did assert herself as an individual. And so once she did, and once I figured out that she was this obituary writer who was 83 years old, had spent her life writing about death, and had some sort of ironic perspective on the fact that she's now towards the end of her own life, then things really did sort of start to fall into place as she was concerned about the newspaper that she worked for, which was struggling, and as she was concerned about this farm woman and the effect of this missing child on their community, as the community itself is trying to keep alive.
Your last novel, which was set among sophisticated yuppies in Omaha, I can imagine how you inhabited those characters more easily. This 80-something-year-old woman in a small town, was that a particular challenge to sort of figure out her voice, really kind of inhabit her for 5 hours a day?
you know, it wasn't. I thought that I should interview 83-year-old yeah. women. I thought I should maybe interview obituary writers. But the more I wrote about her, the more I wrote in her voice, I really did feel like I just needed to get in her skin and sort of get into character like an yeah. actor would. And I think that felt the most natural.
What will you most remember? It's a question I've asked of the grieving hundreds and hundreds of times. The people I ask almost always take a deep breath and exhale. What will I remember? They most always say, looking up and off as they're thinking back. Their first responses, which come too quickly, simply to fill the silence in the room, are unexceptional. Her infectious smile, his playful wink, her bubbly laugh, his gruff demeanor, which disguised his sweet, soft heart. But here's what I do. I write nothing down. I give them absolutely nothing, as if they've not yet said a word. I sit, my skinny legs crossed beneath my long skirt, my steno pad atop my knee, the point of my pen pressed on the paper but not moving, not even to doodle. They know that I know that they can do better than that. To please me, then, they see past their grief and breathe vivid life back into their beloveds in idiosyncratic detail.
Well, one of the things you do beautifully with her, it seems to me, is not impose upon her a, you know, 39-year-old man's idea of the generic elderly lady. She's a human being and not just this cute little old lady.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, she's opinionated and she knows the community and she's kind of a one-woman Greek chorus, I guess, is how uh-huh. I imagined her. She's chronicling the deaths of this community and she's perhaps the one person who knows everything. And so you really, well, you took the pulse of the community by looking at not just who was dead, but you also got a sense of who was surviving them. And it resulted in a kind of communication of an oral history sitting at the dinner table.
Right. Small towns exist in the popular American imagination as, on the one hand, icons of homey, cute, morning in America, Edens. Also, especially in the last 40, 50 years, as these places of bleakness and alienation and loneliness and scariness and crime. You know, I think of the movie Badlands or the real-life murder of the transsexual kid in Nebraska that became the Hillary Swank movie. Your books, interestingly to me and charmingly to me, sort of seem to see both of those sides of small-town middle America.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem all that sunny to me, but at the same time, it's not bleak and despairing. I mean, my family still lives on the farm. I still return to small town Nebraska frequently, and I teach in Lincoln, which is not too far from nowhere, basically. But, I mean, I had the sense growing up that I needed to get out, that everything is happening elsewhere. But then when I started writing about Nebraska is when I returned to it after having left it several years. And you realize that all these things that you were seeing that you took for granted are amazing.
And it's also a setting and a place in all of its senses, the places you write about, the people you write about, that is relatively untrodden territory these days in mainstream fiction, especially done in the way you so wonderfully do it, in this witty, weird, kind of non-portentous way.
Oh, yeah. And it's definitely filtered through my own kind of perverse imagination, I guess. I mean, it's not the landscape that Willa Cather would describe, even though it's literally the same landscape in some
yeah.
cases. I mean, I remember reading places that I was familiar with, rivers
yeah.
that I knew, and actually my town that I grew up outside of Aurora. And so it was legitimizing in a sense, I guess.
For
and
sure.
Kind of profound to discover that I could actually write about this place that I knew, that people actually cared about. You know, I think when you grow up in the Midwest, you have this debilitating sense of modesty, which, you know, that nobody would be interested.
When you drive out through those endless, peopleless plains, whether or not they're broken down farms, but just the general plains, Nebraska landscape, are you more often inspired, feel like you're listening to Aaron Copland, or are you also spooked and depressed?
I don't
Because I feel both, depending on, I don't know, my mood otherwise.
Well, sometimes it can be so vast and empty, you know, that it can be startling. And you do get the sense of what the pioneers must have felt, or the homesteaders, when they attempted to come here and to grow things in this earth that was kind of rebelling against them. But, you know, just to go back to the farm that I grew up on, I mean, it's constantly changing, and it feels like it's a story that's never going to finish being told. You know, it takes on new character all the time. A couple of years ago, a tornado swept through and destroyed some of the structures on the farm. Fortunately, nothing major, but it took out a lot of trees, and it was emotional to see those changes and to see this familiar property really slightly changed, but in a way vastly changed. And so I think that for me, I'm always going to be returning to that farm to try to get to the bottom of something, I guess. I don't know, some connection that I feel.
Timothy Shaffert, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Timothy Shaffert is the author of The Coffins of Little Hope. I asked him what the first line of his obituary would be when he dies. The answer is on our website.
When you wake up feeling old.
So now, your turn. Go to studio360.org or our Facebook page and tell us yours. How would you like the first line of your obituary to read? One sentence only, please, and in the coming weeks, I'll read our favorites on the air.